Hello, and welcome again to another Conservative Historian podcast. This one entitled, African American Conservative Writers, Black History Month Bookshelf. The date, February 2023, and my name is Bell Avis. I began this work prior to the current controversy around Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' decision to oppose a revised AP test curriculum around American history, particularly that of Black Studies. Here is a summary of the kerfuffle. The College Board, the group that runs the SAT and the Advanced Placement Program, launched a pilot version of an AP African American Studies, or APOS, course. The curriculum had not been publicly released, nor have the names of the approximately 60 schools at which the pilot is being tested. This is typical of the Byzantine opacity with which much of curriculum determination exists in the United States. On January 12th, however, the administration of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis wrote a letter to the College Board informing it that Florida was rejecting its request for state approval of APOS. The letter, from the Florida Department of Education's Office of Articulation, goes on to state that, as presented, the content of this course is inexplicably contrary to Florida law and significantly lacks educational value. At the same time, the letter notes that in the future, should College Board be willing to come back to the table with lawful, historically accurate content, FDOE will always be willing to reopen the discussion. In short, DeSantis has decided that APOS does, in fact, violate Florida's Stop Woke Act by attempting to persuade students of at least some tenets of CRT. Florida's Stop Woke Act, for example, bars any K-12 attempt to promote the idea that color blindness is in fact racist. Yet most of the readings in the final quarter of APOS, Unit 4, Movements and Debates, rejects color blindness. One of the topics in that unit is explicitly devoted to color blindness. As writer Nate Hockman points out, there APOS suggests reading CRT advocate Eduardo Bonilla Silva, best known for his theory of colorblind racism. Overall, the readings in the final quarter of APOS, chiefly devoted to ideological controversies rather than history per se, are extraordinarily one-sided. They promote leftist radicalism with virtually no readings, providing even a classically liberal point of view, much less some form of conservatism. If DeSantis were to approve a course pushing the idea of colorblind racism, he would effectively nullify his own Stop Woke Act. Then there's APOS's promotion of socialism. A state doesn't need a pre-existing law to decide that a course filled with advocacy for socialist radicalism is inappropriate. In my earlier exploration of APOS's curriculum, I described the neo-Marxist thrust of the system. This is evident from the readings. On top of that, however, we know that Joshua M. Myers, the member of the APOS curriculum writing team whose expertise covers the final quarter of the course, is an acolyte of Cedric Robinson, author of Black Marxism, The Making of the Black Radical Tradition. Myers' writings on African American studies explicitly call for the field to reject traditional concepts of disciplinary neutrality and adopt openly anti-capitalist radical advocacy instead. In short, for DeSantis to approve the APOS course as currently configured would be to repudiate everything he stands for. It would welcome woke, not stop it. Looking at our nation today, there are some startling comments from our youth. For example, a new poll conducted by College Pulse, a polling firm that surveys students in higher education, that surveyed more than 10,000 students in May 2019, shows that 4 in 10 students, or 39%, have a favorable view of socialism than capitalism. Will that same percentage, 39%, have an unfavorable view of socialism? In a poll conducted by U.S. News & World Report, an incredulous Stephen Ross Johnson noted that only 53% of agreed with the survey question, do you believe there is systemic racism in America? We imagine that Johnson is wondering what is wrong with that 47%. And the margins for African Americans were much higher at over 81%. Yes, over 81% of African Americans would completely agree with the statement that we are, in fact, a systemically racist nation. Ross Johnson wondered what was wrong with the 30% of whites and the 10% of blacks who did not believe this. And in a Pew Research study, it was noted that 23% said the U.S. stands above all other countries in the world. But roughly a quarter, 23%, there are other countries that are better than the U.S. Differences exist by age and party. Those ages 65 and older were the most likely to say the U.S. stands above all other countries, 38%, while adults ages 18 to 29 were the least likely to say this, only 10%. Think about those three stats in cumulative. Number one, that students think that socialism is at least equal to or superior to our capitalist system. Two, that we are basically a systemically racist nation. And that three, again, 90% of young people ages 18 to 29 would contend that the United States is not that shining beacon on the hill as envisioned by Ronald Reagan. So, how did it come to this? Much of this is of a type of education and training that our young people receive in our schools. So, for example, the 1619 Project, a collection of national falsehoods masquerading as history, is now taught in thousands of schools and has an extensive documentary coming up. This once stealth education, but now more and more it is moving into the light, plant seeds of perniciousness in the curriculum. And it is how you have the wealthiest and one of the freest nations on earth denigrated by its own young people. Nowhere is this more prevalent than on the topic of race. Okay, so that is the disease. So if reading Robinson and Myers might help to turn our young into junior activist Marxists, what is the cure to this disease? Well, I can't prescribe an entire cure, but I can at least set us, hopefully, in a better direction. And my direction is how about some conservatism? Though the left does not acknowledge them, the right has historically presented several important and very incisive black voices. So, before you go for the usual Ta-Nehisi Paul Coates or the odious 1619 Project for your Black History Month, check some of these out. First, let's start with Booker T. Washington's Up From Slavery. This work is the 1901 autobiography of Booker T. Washington detailing his slow and steady rise from a slave child during the Civil War to the difficulties and obstacles he overcame to get an education at the New Hampton University, to his work establishing vocational schools, most notably the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, and to helping black people and other disadvantaged minorities learn valuable, marketable skills and work to pull themselves as a race up by the bootstraps. I know that's not a good term anymore in a lot of our educational things, pull yourself up by the bootstraps, because of course that requires agency. It also requires determination, focus, even a certain relentlessness. And yet that is what Washington's talking about. And that, I think, is at least one of the cures for this disease. Finally, Washington reflects on the generosity of teachers and philanthropists who helped educate blacks and Native Americans. Here's a passage from the book. It's not one of his most, if you will, philosophical passages. It just tells a brief story. But I think in this brief story, he talks volumes. At present, one of the most satisfactory features of Christmas and Thanksgiving season at Tuskegee is the unselfish and beautiful way our graduates and students spend their time in administering to the comfort and happiness of others, especially the unfortunate. Not long ago, some of our young men spent a holiday in rebuilding a cabin for a helpless colored woman who is about 75 years old. At another time, I remember that I made it known in chapel, one night that a very poor student was suffering from cold because he needed a coat. The next morning, two coats were sent to my office for him. What I love about Washington is his sense of personal agency. You will not find that pernicious victimology so common today, not just in race discourse, but in all conversations. And it pains me to say this, but that kind of victimology is starting to infect the right as well. Not Washington, though. His students and the teacher act. They are not acted upon. Thomas Sowell, Indiscrimination and Disparities, written in 2019. Thomas Sowell describes how economists think about the causes of disparities in socioeconomic outcomes, but cautions against government intervention to reduce disparities, noting that such interventions have often have historical unintended consequences. Ibram X. Kendi, the famous anti-racist activist, has famously said, "When I see racial disparities, I see racism." Sowell simply tears that theory apart. The assumption that discriminatory bias can be automatically inferred when there are differences in socioeconomic outcomes, and that the source of that bias can be determined by where the statistics were collected, well, it seems indefensible. Yet, that seemingly invincible fallacy guides much of what is said and done in our educational institutions, the media, and government policies. Sowell adds, "Contrary to much of what has been said, disparities in socioeconomic outcomes are neither improbable from a theoretical standpoint nor uncommon from an empirical standpoint." Sowell argues that though racial discrimination does exist, it is neither the sole nor the primary cause for racial disparity. Just because there are some disparities between groups does not necessarily mean it's someone's fault and requires governmental fixing. Here's just one nugget that Sowell presents to explain the differences. Lots of interesting minimum wage laws discussions. In 1948, Sowell argues, there was no minimum wage law, and the unemployment rate between young black and white males showed no significant difference. Yet after minimum wage laws went into effect, unemployment for young black males was regularly twice as high as young white males in subsequent years. Minimum wage increases can also decrease the number of jobs available or the number of hours employees work. Studies looking at the number of employees and the number of hours performed showed that in 2016, minimum wage laws actually lowered low-wage employees' earnings by an average of $125 per month. Also in the 1920s, under Calvin Coolidge, when there were no minimum wage laws, unemployment ranged from 4.2% down to 1.8%. Shelby Steele, The Content of Our Character, 1998. Shelby Steele illuminates the origins of the current conflict in race relations, the increase in anger, mistrust, and even violence between blacks and whites. And keep in mind, dear listener, we're talking about his writing of this in 1998. With candor and persuasive argument, Steele shows us how black and white Americans have become trapped into seeing color before character, and how social policies designed to lessen racial inequalities have increased them. Again, I know 1998, so let's fast forward to our current date. This is being recorded in February of 2023. Has the increased injection of color into the argument made our race relations better, or have they made them worse? Interesting question, 25 years later after the writing of this book. Steele's contention is that discussions of race and racism in current-day America have become dull and stagnant and unacceptable and embarrassing to a certain extent. Racism has become dull as much as it is discussed, using preconceived notions circulated around society for several years and offering nothing fresh. It has become a virtually taboo topic, as if it wasn't before. Obviously, something has changed in 25 years. It is not a taboo topic at all. if you want to talk about all of the inequalities and DEI, it's everywhere. If you want to talk, though, about culture, or as Sowell does, about government intervention creating some of those inequalities inadvertently, well, that is not talked about nearly as much. And as evidenced by the discomfort of both blacks and whites when the subject is broached, particularly if the discussion sways from the usual rhetoric that the public has become accustomed to. Again, 25 years later, DEI is in the saddle, and anything, let's say, of a cultural discussion is off the table. The author discusses issues such as race holding, which he describes as the mechanism triggered by a fear that ensnares blacks. As Steele states, in a web of self-defeating attitudes that end up circumventing the new freedoms won over the past several decades. Black historical experience of injustice is now victimization, the centerpiece of cultural and group identity. Blacks today are freer than ever in history, yet their identity is more grounded in victimization than ever. He finishes with this: conservatism is the perfect antidote to underdevelopment. Its commitment to individual responsibility, education, hard work, personal initiative, traditional family values, and free markets is a universal formula for success in a free society. Walter E. Williams, Up From the Projects, 2010. Nationally syndicated columnist and prolific author, and as a few years ago, sadly, the late Walter E. Williams, recalls some of the highlights and turning points of his life in this book. From his lower middle class beginnings in a mixed but predominantly black neighborhood in West Philadelphia to his department chair at George Mason University, William tells us an only in America kind of story of a life of achievement. Williams describes the influences of his early years, such as teachers who demanded his best efforts and made no excuses for him, and tells how his 2 years in the Army became an essential part of his maturation process, despite the racism he did encounter. He recounts his early time getting established in Los Angeles, getting his BA, and going on to grad school at UCLA and beginning his teaching career. And he tells how his subsequent move to the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. opened his eyes to how decisions are actually made in the Capitol. When he recounts ultimately accepting his professorship appointment at George Mason University, the author marvels, "I never thought I'd be working there 30 years later." And throughout the book, Williams refers to the immeasurable contribution of his wife of 48 years, who shared his vision through hard work and love. Michael L. Ondaatje, Black Conservative Intellectuals in Modern America, written in 2012. Okay, I'm slightly breaking from my theme of black writers, though in the parlance of the left, the Shwaronkan-born Ondaatje would be a person of color. His book contains too much exciting content to lead him off the list. In the last three decades, he argues, a brand of black conservatism espoused by a controversial group of African-American intellectuals has become a fixture in the nation's political landscape. Its proponents having shaped policy debates over some of the most pressing matters that confront contemporary American society. Their ideas, though, have been neglected by scholars of the African-American experience, and much of the responsibility for explaining black conservatism's historical and contemporary significance has fallen to highly partisan journalists, of course. It's because their acceptance within the academy is always going to be limited as long as the academy is ruled by the progressive ethos. Typically, those pundits have addressed black conservatives as an undifferentiated mass, proclaiming them good or bad, right or wrong, colorblind visionaries. Remember the colorblind racist, that racism that we had mentioned that they were trying to inject into the AP studies, and one of my favorites, because it's just so heinous, is that often black conservative intellectuals are labeled as Uncle Toms. Ondaatje delves deeply into the historical archive to chronicle the origins of black conservatism in the United States from the early 1980s to the present, focusing on three significant policy issues: affirmative action, welfare, and education. And Taji critically engages with the ideas of 9 of the most influential black conservatives, and he further documents how their ideas were received, both by white conservatives, eager obviously to capitalize on black support for their ideas, that would be natural, and by activists on the left, who too often sought to impugn the motives of black conservatives instead of challenging the merits of their claims. While Ntaji's investigation uncovers the themes and issues that link these voices, he debunks the myth of the monolithic black conservatism. And the black conservatives he's talking about? Well, some of the figures are on this list, but they also include Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. They also include the Hoover Institution's Thomas Sowell, as we'd mentioned before, Shelby Steele, and cultural theorist John McWhorter emerge as individuals with distinct understandings of and relationships to the conservative political tradition. And, as the author noted, it is not a monolithic view. There are several disagreements, but there are also several pieces that are of a piece with the right. Jason Riley, False Black Power 2017. Black civil rights leaders have long supported ethnic identity politics and prioritized the integration of political institutions, and seldom has that strategy been questioned. Now in False Black Power, Jason Riley takes an honest, factual look at why increased black political power has not paid off in the ways that civil rights leadership had promised. Recent decades have witnessed a proliferation of black elected officials, culminating in the historic presidency of Barack Obama. However, racial gaps in employment, income, homeownership, academic achievement, and other measures have not continued, but in some cases even widened. Moreover, while other racial and ethnic groups in America have prioritized economic advancement, the focus on political capital for blacks has been a disadvantage, blocking them from the financial capital that helped powered upward mobility among other groups. Riley explains in this book why the political strategy of civil rights leaders has left so many blacks behind. Today's key to black economic advancement is overcoming cultural handicaps and not attaining more political power. The book closes with thoughtful responses from critical thinkers such as Glenn Lowry and the aforementioned John McWhorter. And speaking of McWhorter, John McWhorter winning the race, 2005. For decades after the great victories of the civil rights movement secured equal rights for African Americans, Black America is still in crisis. And again, think about that these books all predate the election of Barack Obama, the Michael Brown hoax that he was somehow gunned down by police, and the George Floyd killing. Now, back to McWhorter. Black Americans in crisis. Indeed, by most measurable standards, conditions for many blacks have grown worse since 1965. Desperate poverty cripples communities nationwide. Incarceration rates have reached record highs. Teen pregnancy and out-of-wedlock births are rampant. And educational failures are stifling achievement among the next generation. And I should note that in the last 18 years, none of these things have fundamentally changed. For years, prominent sociologists and pundits have blamed these problems on forces outside the black community, and they still do. From lingering racism to the explosion of the inner-city drug trade, to the erosion of the urban industrial base, and the migration of middle-class blacks to the suburbs. But now, in an essential and broad-ranging re-envisioning of the post-civil rights black American experience, McWhorter tears down these theories to expose the true roots of today's crisis and show a new way forward. And I would argue that winning the race is as pertinent today as it was 18 years ago. McWhorter argues that black Americans' current problems began with an unintended byproduct of the civil rights revolution, a crippling mindset of therapeutic alienation. This wary stance towards mainstream American culture, although it is a legacy of racism in the past, continues to hold blacks back, and McWhorter traces all the poisonous effects of this defeatist attitude. And I always wonder what 2005 McWhorter would have made of something, for example, the Smithsonian Edict, in which they said they equated the concept of hard work to white culture. McWhorter provides an in-depth case study of the Indianapolis inner city. He analyzes how a vibrant black neighborhood declined into slums despite ample work opportunities in an American urban center where manufacturing jobs were plentiful. Next, McWhorter takes a hard look at the legacy of the Great Society social assistance programs, lamenting their teaching people to live permanently on welfare, as well as educational failures too often occurring because of an intellectual climate in which a successful black person must be faced with charges of acting white. Finally, he attacks the sorry state of black popular culture, where indignation for its own sake has been enshrined in everything from the halls of academia to the deleterious policy decisions of community leaders to the disaffected lyrics of hip-hop, particularly rap's glorification of irresponsibility and violence as protest. In a stirring conclusion, McWhorter puts forth a new vision of black political and intellectual leadership, arguing that both blacks and whites must abolish the culture of victimhood, as this alone can improve the future of black America, and outline steps that can be taken to ensure hope for the future. And one more Jason Riley book on one of our writers. This book is about Thomas Sowell. It's called Maverick, and it was written in 2020. Riley notes that Sowell is one of the great social theorists of our age, which Riley's right about that. In a career spanning more than a half century, Sowell has written over 30 books covering topics from economic history and social inequality to political theory, race, and culture. His bold and unsentimental assaults on liberal orthodoxy have endeared him to many readers, but have also enraged fellow intellectuals, the civil rights establishment, and much of the mainstream media. The result has been a need for acknowledgement of his scholarship among critics who prioritize political correctness. In the first ever biography of Sowell, Jason Riley gives this iconic thinker his due in response to the detractors. Maverick showcases Sowell's most significant writings and traces the life events that shaped his ideas and resulted in a black orphan from the Jim Crow South becoming one of our foremost public intellectuals. So, dear listener, put aside that Michelle Alexander book. Cancel your purchase of W.E.B. Du Bois and avoid plunking downtime and treasure on James Baldwin. Oh, okay, well, actually, for now, Baldwin is actually a pretty interesting figure. And Baldwin is an intriguing read. So instead, do not buy Imran X. Kendi. And obviously, this is going to come as a shock. Do not, for whatever reason, read that 1619 project, or read it if you wish to critique it, either way. Instead, though, just for this month, try this bookshelf. And if you have strange feelings of, I don't know, optimism about our nation, do not attribute this to the glass of Cabernet you just ingested, or that your sports team has just won. Instead, consider that with these writers' belief in conservatism and our nation, we, as a society, can get to a better place. Thank you for listening to this latest Conservative Historian podcast. Please check out all of our podcasts. I think we're up to 140. I should check that number. As always, thanks for listening.